My Taste with Catena, brought to you by Bibendum Wine with Jazz FM.
Hello, I'm Ben McCormack, the editor of squaremeal.co.uk. Welcome to our programme that aims to expand and improve your knowledge of food and drink through the perspective of chefs, restaurant owners and wine experts. Today I'm talking to Dan Doherty, who in 2013 was awarded the title of Tatler magazine's Rising Star Chef. And, well, he's certainly risen now, because Dan is the executive chef at Duck & Waffle in the City of London, which at 40 floors up in the Heron Tower is the UK's highest restaurant. Dan, welcome to the programme.
Thank you for having me.
I'm guessing from where you work then that you're not scared of heights.
Well, I'm not scared of heights in terms of being inside somewhere that's high up, but sometimes I remember when I first went up there and we went to the balcony in Sushi Samba and looked over, and then I realised I probably am a little bit scared of heights. But I think if you look at over anything that high up, it's a bit like, you know, Jesus. But yeah.
So you've got one of the best views in the world where you work. You've got the skyscrapers of the city all around you, the dome of St Paul's Cathedral, and a view all the way down the river to the Houses of Parliament. When you started working at Duck & Waffle, how long did it take you to stop staring at that view and to start concentrating on the food?
Well, we were always concentrating on the food, because the way we looked at the view was that, you know, a lot of restaurants have different things to compete with. And ours was something that was the view. That was our biggest competitor, because, you know, by the time you've come up the lift, you've been whisked up in that glass lift. You walk out, you walk through the bar that's kind of like an inside-out bar, and people are having a good time. You walk through, you kind of see the open kitchen, you smell the food, then you see the view. So to try and maintain that adrenaline, that was our biggest kind of competitor. But in terms of me looking at the view, I mean, yeah, it's breathtaking. Mm. But even now, like 3.5 years, I think it is, people come and they're like, wow, this view is amazing. And you're like, yeah, because you know, you just kind of adjust to it, right? And you just get used to it, which is kind of sad. You only notice the change. You notice the change in the sun and things like that.
So. Not too jaded then. No. So as well as being the UK's highest restaurant, Duck & Waffle's also famous for having round-the-clock opening hours. You're open for 24 hours a day. Presumably, though, your working day isn't quite as long as that.
It has been once or twice, but no, we have a very good structure. It took us a long time to get used to it, but actually, being open 24 hours is a lot easier to manage than doing breakfast, lunch and dinner, because it kind of ties the whole circle up, so that, you know, that the evening chefs before they go are setting up for the night chefs, and in turn they're setting up for the breakfast chefs, so the breakfast chefs can start at 6 rather than sort of 4, you know. So it's but yeah, don't get me wrong, it's, I wouldn't recommend it to everyone.
So Duck & Waffle is a 24-hour restaurant. It's 40 floors above the pavement. I'm sure many chefs would have run a mile from this kind of project. But was there a challenge there that really appealed to you?
The height was just an added bonus. But the 24-hour thing was appealing, because no one's really done it before. I know there's a few places in London that are open 24 hours. But to do, they're much more kind of, their catchment zone is, it's much more relaxed and informal, and we are relaxed and informal, but we wanted to do an actual proper restaurant. And I don't mean anything bad towards the other places, but we wanted it to be a restaurant where you could go 24 hours a day that's kind of similar at any time point. And lots of people, I mean like a hell of a lot of people, said it was a stupid idea, it will never work, you know. And then now these are the people that are kind of upset they can't get in. So it's, you know, on the weekend, we'll do sort of 350 dining covers between midnight and 5 o'clock in the morning, which it's amazing. And I'll be honest, when we first sort of spoke about it, I didn't think it would work either. But it just shows London's changing, and it had to change to, you know, with, I know the tube's changing soon, but the licensing and all of that, it's a very slow process compared to cities like New York or Singapore and Hong Kong and Shanghai. But it was always going to evolve, because London is one of the best cities in the world for that kind of thing. So,
and with all those diners coming through the door, are there certain dishes that everyone orders? Any signature dishes on the menu?
Well, I mean, you know, naming the restaurant after a dish is always going to stimulate people to order that dish. But it depends on the time of day. You know, for breakfast, we call it Colombian egg. So it's based on the South American, it's called perico, which is essentially scrambled eggs with spring onions and tomatoes. And I saw it when I was in Miami once. This kid was making it because he was hungover. And I thought, hang on a second, that's a really good vegetarian. Not we wanted to cater specifically for that, but we wanted something that wasn't meat focused. So we whacked it on toast with some avocado, some grilled chorizo or smoked salmon. And that flies out. I mean, that's our signature breakfast thing, I'd say. And then obviously the Duck & Waffle. We do oxcheek donuts, barbecue pig's ears, whole roast chicken. So, and then overnight, you know, overnight was an interesting one. I imagined it to be really refined raw dishes, that people were drinking champagne, being elegant, looking over the view. Couldn't have been further from the truth. It was, all we sell is the heavy indulgent. We've had to tweak the menu so much. It's duck eggs baked in cream with wild mushrooms and truffles and Gruyere cheese, or the ox cheek donut, or the duck and waffle dish. People want sort of substance, you know.
And that's sort of at 3 a.m, that's the kind of stuff that people are ordering.
Absolutely. And like I say, I was reluctant to change the menu because I wanted it to be like that. But then, you know, you got to give people what they want, right?
Yeah, so I've got to upgrade my idea of what a midnight snack is, I think, next time I'm digging around in the fridge on the way back from the pub. Some fairly way out sounding dishes there, like a spicy ox cheek donut. But you actually served your apprenticeship at a Michelin-starred restaurant in the city of London, 1 Lombard Street. Was it important to you as a chef to have that classical training and grounding?
I think it's, looking back, absolutely 100%. At the time, I don't think I really thought about it. I was very lucky that the scholarship I did with the Academy of Culinary Arts, they place you in somewhere that they think you are best suited to. So you do basically a year's education in 3 months, like really condensed and intense. And then they say, okay, so you're best suited to the Ritz, or you're best suited to somewhere else. And I got placed into 1 Lombard Street, and you never really know why. It was phenomenal. I mean, I think it's so important to have that foundation. I was very lucky that the timing that I decided to become a chef was, I had long enough in a very classically trained restaurant, but also I was young enough for when this kind of modern thing kind of exploded. I'm not talking about molecular, but I mean where the boundaries are kind of non-existent anymore, where people are free to do anything they want. You know, the things you see people creating now are amazing. And I feel like I'm very lucky to have been on that cusp of not too old to start reinventing yourself, but also young enough to absorb it all in and sort of, yeah.
Herbert Berger, the chef that you trained with, I think has referred to you as his protege, and you referred to him as your mentor. And you're now involved in the Chefs of Tomorrow initiative, which is developing the talent of young chefs around the UK. Could you tell us a little about that? And are you now in the role of mentor yourself?
For me, I'd love to be looked at as a mentor to someone, because I think it's important to help someone along their career, whether it's just advice or cooking or whatever. But the Chefs of Tomorrow, the idea behind that was that I think lots of people are talking about there's a crisis and that there's not enough chefs and there's too many restaurants. And my thoughts on that are that a lot of the stuff we have on TV don't necessarily show it in a way that makes people want to become a chef. So chefs, people who...
You mean sort of too aggressive and
yeah,
shouty.
And I think the pinnacle is always, if you win this, you will then get to work in a 3 Michelin-star restaurant, or you spend the semi-finals of a competition is 2 Michelin-star restaurants.
So a bit like a talent contest.
Yeah, but if you're already a chef, it's like, wow, the winners get to go and work at XYZ, and that's great. But I think if you're a sort of 14, 15-year-old kid and you're looking at, you like food, that I don't think that's a true representation of the industry. I think for every one restaurant that is intense and it's phenomenally hard and the things they do are amazing, don't get me wrong. But I don't think for every one of those, there's probably 100 restaurants that are kind of normal, as in, you know, it doesn't need to be that intense. I think people can relax a bit more and enjoy it. So I wanted to create something that maybe would hopefully turn into a documentary one day, and people would see that it doesn't need to be like that. People can be in an informal environment, learn and enjoy cooking for what it is. And I think from the angle of the kids, I say kids, you know, sort of, they can be any age, but young in their career, we wanted them to have a snippet of what it's like to be a head chef or an executive chef or whatever. So they take ownership of the night. They work together. So these four guys or girls have never met each other before. They collaborate on a menu. Obviously, I'm helping them to make sure it goes together. And then they go and cook it together. And what happened was, by not having a competitive element to it, they realized that if they help each other, then the outcome was much better for everyone. So if one guy does amazing and one guy does bad, the dinner has a negative effect on everyone. Whereas if they all pull together and help each other, and that happened organically, that was just something that happened, and we realized that's why we don't want a competitive element to it. We want it to just be that they get to cook together, enjoy, and as they're doing it, they're going to make mistakes, and you're standing there and you're like, oh, I really want to help them, but you also need to let them learn. And
so who else is involved in this project?
The first restaurant was at Jose Pizarro's restaurant in Bermondsey. Then we did it at L'Escargot, we did it at Petersham Nurseries, we did it at Sam's of Brighton. So we have like a really nice mix of places. So the idea was to constantly keep changing it, so it's growing all the time, you know? And then the last side to the triangle is that the guests. So I like football and I like watching youth football because it's nice to see who could be the next you know, messy, you know? And I think it's like that with the chefs. If you come along and you have, you know, some young guy who cooks this amazing dish, in 10 years' time, he may sort of be this lauded chef. Mm. And you could be like, oh, I remember him. He did that really interesting thing with oysters and banana or whatever. So,
back to your own training and experience. After One Lombard Street, you worked in a fairly wide variety of restaurants, from fine dining in Mayfair at Noble Rot to modern European at the Ambassador in Clerkenwell, and then modern British at the Empress in East London. Did that variety help form you as a chef?
Yeah, I was very... I think by the time I'd left Lombard Street, I really wanted to go to Le Gavroche, because I wanted to continue in the Michelin thing and to continue with that sort of... You know, I was very proud. I wanted to be very proud to look back at my CV and say, you know, I did a very structured kind of approach to it. But then also I wanted to make sure I mixed it up a bit and try to do something different with each change. So Noble Rot was a logical thing. It was a much more... It's actually my favourite job, I think, I've ever had. I remember I was a chef de partie there, and the food was just so different and so had this really modern feel to it. And it was the chef there was a guy called Julian Owen Mould, and he was amazing. So yeah, and then going on to the Ambassador, but that was actually my first head chef job, and too young to, I was only 23, I think, and that was me kind of cooking what I thought I wanted to cook. And I also learned that I was too young to be a head chef there, and you know, we did it for a year and we achieved great things, you know, we got some great accolades, but it was hard. And it was makes you realize sometimes when you're young and hungry and you think I want, and then you get there and you're like, okay, relax. But then I didn't step down. I just changed, you know, I took like 3 months off and kind of worked as a private chef for a while in Switzerland, and then came back, and then that's when I went to the Empress.
There's kind of different challenges as a private chef to being a chef in a restaurant.
Yeah, it's bad. I did it because I wanted a holiday and I wanted to go skiing. So I was working for a Russian billionaire, and I remember the first morning he gave me a list of the stuff he wanted for breakfast. So we did different homemade granolas and smoothies and omelets and hams and cheeses, and then kind of a full English home-baked pastry. You know, we made our own puff pastry, you know, croissants and stuff, home-baked bread and all this stuff, in a massive table full of food. And they came down and they just had cereal. So then the second day, like up again at 4:30, same thing again, just had cereal. And I was like, okay, so I'm just going to give cereal if that's all they want. So I gave cereal, and he's like, whoa, where's all the other stuff? I was like, I'm sorry, I didn't realise you want it. He goes, that's up to me to decide if I want it or not, but I want you to make it. And then it was, you know, then we'd go straight into preparing. We'd have to make every day a different cake and 3 or 4 different biscuits, different sandwiches and savouries. And then it was 5 different canapés and a 9-course tasting menu for dinner with, again, different breads. It was the hardest thing I've ever done.
And did you get to do any skiing?
No, I went twice. Twice in 3 months. I swear to God, it was the lowest paid and the most hours I've ever worked in my life.
When you were at the Empress in East London, I think you were going to Billingsgate Market, to the fish market at 5 a.m. every morning, and you were sourcing your meat from small farms out in the countryside. As a chef, is that contact with producers and ingredients, is that very important to you?
It's certainly important to me, and it should be important to everyone. I think it's very hard to do that at Duckamore now because it's, you know, the volume we do and stuff. But we still buy from all the farms. I just don't get to go there every morning or connect with them as much, just because the restaurant's so busy and it's so kind of like on top of a skyscraper. It's hard to sort of, you know, there's a massive disconnect. But at the Empress, it was a small enough restaurant to allow me to do that. So the reason I started going to the market is because it was so close to the restaurant, and because I couldn't hit my food cost, because we were, you know, we're a small place, we wanted to be affordable. And I was like, how can we save money on the fish? So we went to Billingsgate one morning and realized the significance in price difference, and you say, I want that, you know, and you could, that's such an amazing thing to have. And it was good fun, you know. I used to go with the owner of the restaurant. We used to go on Tuesdays and Fridays. It was twice a week we used to go. There's a little cafe at the end, so we used to have a full English afterwards at like 6:30 or something, go to the restaurant and then prepare all the fish. So it was a long day, but it was totally worth it. And I'd like to be able to do more things like that, but I think it's a massive investment of time.
Something you'd recommend that listeners who are into their food and their fish, that they should go and spend a morning at Billingsgate shopping?
Honestly, it's like, I live around the corner from it, and we go there rather than buying fish in a supermarket. You don't really know. Yes, it has a date on it, but you don't know what's happened to that package. You know, has it been left out while they're unloading? Is it done? How was it when it went into the packet? All, you know, these kind of things. So when you go to the market, we go there and we buy, you know, 2 sides of salmon, a side of cod, a box of sea bass, and then we just cut it, prepare it, freeze it, and then, you know, we have the freshest fish, you know, throughout the couple of months. And it's such a nice thing. You buy a couple of lobsters for sort of £5 each, You know, that's an affordable dinner, right? If you go to a restaurant, it's going to be 40 quid.
Yeah, I'm going to have lobster every day from now on. That sounds brilliant.
The only condition is you've got to be there at 5 in the morning. So.
Worth getting up for anyway.
I think so.
Something else I read was you saying that as a chef, there is no greater feeling than to watch someone eat and see a smile come across their face as they have this aha moment. Is that something you think about when you're creating dishes? I mean, something like your signature duck and waffle, which is crispy leg confit, fried duck egg and mustard maple syrup. That must have given quite a few aha moments on people's faces.
Yeah, I think I worded it a little bit differently, but it wasn't publishable. So, but it's, you know, that's the biggest compliment, I guess, or the biggest thing. You know, people, when they eat something, you can't fake that natural reaction. And when you do, you know, like I say, the kitchen's, you know, really open. We can kind of see everyone. And when they eat something and you see them have that moment, is what I think I said, that makes you realise, oh, yeah, that I've achieved something today, you know.
And which dish would you say has been your greatest success?
I'd say the spicy ox cheek donut has been kind of something different that, to me, makes a lot of sense. I think the original idea behind it was, you know, the steam bun, the Chinese steam buns. But then lots of people were doing them. That dish is like 3 years old now, and lots of people were doing them. And I remember thinking, even more so now actually, but I remember thinking I couldn't do it because Momofuku had done it. And I was like, oh, it's a bit kind of like a bit too similar. So we thought about, what about if we deep fry it? And then it was like, well, don't be stupid, just do a donut. That's essentially what a donut is, right? It's a risen pastry that's been deep fried. So, or a risen dough. So ultimately it's a fluffy vehicle for slow cooked meat.
What about back home? You live down in Canary Wharf with your wife. Can you see your home from the restaurant?
Yeah, I can actually, which is kind of depressing because it means you can see the restaurant from home. but yeah, I live nearby and I'm lucky that there are some really good places opening up. Mm. My local place that I go to, and I say it all the time, but Goodman's Steakhouse is a stone's throw from where we live. And it's not only is the food phenomenal, but the service is just so good. And it's probably the only, not the only, but one of the only restaurants that competes with the servers in New York for how sort of on point they are. And that doesn't mean being refined or stuffy, but it's just relaxed. They know you, they remember what you like. And you know what it's like, you have a great bottle of wine, you go back 2 months later and you can't remember what it was. And they're like, it was this. And you're like, oh, wow. You know? So yeah, I love it there.
What about out of London? Do you get out of town at all? And if so, do you have any favourite places to go?
I don't get out of town that much, but I remember when we did the Chefs of Tomorrow thing, we did it in Brighton once, and there was a couple of restaurants down there that stood out to me because of the chefs that they put forward for Chefs of Tomorrow, but also we went to eat at them on the morning of and to check them out. And that's what I was talking about with the America thing. You're seeing a city like Brighton that's going through its food revolution right now, and you got places like Silo, or Silo, however you say it, 64 Degrees. These places are, you know, it's almost like you get an amazing chef who's been working in London, realizes that it's expensive and kind of congested in London, and then they go to another city and open up. And that's how, I'm not sure if that's what happened, but that's how it feels like. And the food there is new and exciting.
How about if you have a special occasion to celebrate a birthday, an anniversary, where would you go for a real blowout meal or somewhere that means a lot to you in terms of memories?
For me, it's the River Cafe. I think that's a restaurant that has so much soul in everything they do, and knowing how fresh they cook their ingredients. You know, they get their stuff in the morning, and then they kind of just decide what they're going to cook. They quickly write a menu, distribute the dishes to the chefs, and then they cook amazing food. And there's so much heart and soul there. You know, you do pay for that, but I think it's the perceived, it's all about perceived value, right? So. Yeah, it was really good.
And do you have any all-time favourite dishes? When you're reading a menu, you spot one thing and think, oh, there's no point in me reading the rest of this menu because what I'm going to have.
Oh, at the River Cafe or
at the River Cafe or in general?
I think anywhere that there's a good veal, anywhere that there's a good veal chop, like a Côte d'Ivoire or something like that, I find it hard to turn that down. There's certain things like cassoulets and steak tartares and pasta and ragu. All of those things just jump out at me, and it's very hard to say no.
So, Dan, you've brought along a bottle to try from the Duck and Waffle wine list. It's an Argentinian wine, Catena Malbec Vista Flores 2012. It's made from Malbec, which is, of course, the most famous red grape from Argentina, and it's grown up in the Mendoza region. So could you tell us a little bit about why you like this wine?
Well, I love Malbec in general. It's probably my favourite grape, and Argentinian Malbec is just so smooth and approachable, and you know, I love it with anything really, with great pasta, with steaks, and you know, that kind of stuff. I just think it's so soft, and it kind of ticks all the boxes you want.
Let's give it a taste. I mean, I think it's got those lovely kind of dark, chocolatey flavours for this time of year. It's just perfect. You can imagine kind of closing the curtains and curling up on the sofa watching a box set with this beside you, can't you?
Yeah, I could do that right about now, actually.
What would you like to eat with this?
I'd have a nice, you know, homemade Italian pasta with ragu, you know, nice and comforting, like you say, rainy day, close curtains and get stuck in.
Well, Dan, thanks very much for coming in and sharing your life in food and restaurants with us. And wish you all the best for the future. And
thank you.
Come back and see us another time, I hope.
No problem. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
My Taste with Catena. Quality Argentinian wines. Hear the complete programme again and find out more about Catena wine at jazzfm.com/bibendumwine.